Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. We're going to be doing two shows on observatories, ancient and modern. Today we will explore an ancient observatory in Ireland with the director of the Griffith Park Observatory, Dr. Edwin Krupp. He's given us some gorgeous images that you'll want to look at while you're listening to the audio track. So open a second window, go to my website, guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, and from the menu of radio shows, bring up today's show, An Ancient Observatory. Dr. Krupp has been the director of Griffith Observatory for 35 years, and he got his PhD from UCLA from one of the most famous of all American astronomers, George Abel. Dr. Krupp has been the host on a TV series called Project Universe on PBS, and he is acknowledged as a leading world expert on astronomy of ancient societies and how their astronomy affected those societies. He has visited about 1,900 ancient astronomical sites, and he is the author of numerous books. He's written at least four books for children, including The Moon and You, as well as books for adults, including In Search of Ancient Astronomers, Archaeoastronomy and the Roots of Science, Echoes of Ancient Skies, Beyond the Blue Horizon, and Sky Watchers, Shamans, and Kings. Dr. Krupp, welcome to our show.
Thanks an awful lot, and delighted, obviously, to be guided to cosmos.
Thank you. So, Ed, I understand that you just came back from visiting one of these ancient astronomical sites in Ireland. Would you tell us about that?
Sure. And in fact, I was in Ireland briefly, right at the time of the winter solstice, to have a look at a place called New Grange. And New Grange is located just about 30 miles to the north of Dublin, but it is certainly not as recent as Dublin. This monument is prehistoric and was constructed more than 5,000 years ago, around 3300 B.C., Yeah, in fact, it's older than the pyramids by several centuries. So the monument is, in fact, extraordinary, both for its age, but also then for the complexity, the solidity, the design. When you think about who was there and what they were doing at that time, these are herders, farmers, some kind of a chiefdom, perhaps, not exactly a kingdom, in Ireland, that is building a giant mound of rock and earth over what's called a passage grave. And the passage grave is made of giant stones, very big stones called megaliths. You can sort of think of, well, something like Stonehenge, although they're not that big. But it's not put together with mortar. These stones are just set upright and then set over as capstones and such. But the remarkable thing is that this passage grave, as it's sometimes called, is still standing after more than 5,000 years. So the folks that built it knew what they were doing.
Is that possibly the oldest building in the world then?
You know, there are older prehistoric monuments than that. You can find them in places like northwest France, also in the Malta. There are prehistoric temples that are, for all practical purposes, as intact as New Grange. Doesn't mean they're completely still all together, but some of the structures that at least survive in Malta are from around 7,000 years old.
My God, that's really remarkable. I didn't know there were any major structures in the world that were that old.
Yeah, and we find evidence of other structures even older than that, of course, but most of those are detected just by perhaps foundation remains or even lines, the changes of color in the earth, that kind of thing. But as far as an actual standing structure is concerned, you're pretty much pushing the limit. I wouldn't say this is the absolute limit, but by the time you get to 7,000-8,000 years ago, you're kind of there.
Right. So image number one on the website shows a view of the site from a distance. So this is the total site view.
Yeah.
And image number two shows the entrance to the site.
Yeah, but these are both curious aspects of this place. Again, it's been called a passage grave because that entrance that you see, the doorway, leads through a long passage, many tens of feet long, almost to the center of this earthen and rock mound, where there are three chambers, sort of in the shape of a kind of a little cross shape, two side chambers and the back chamber, and they have a vault over them that's a lintled vault. That is, they're pushing the stones in a little further at each level, so it's not like an arch with a big capstone on the top that actually was designed to drain water away from those areas inside and keep them dry. The view from a distance, I don't know what you would say it looks like. Maybe like a giant white hockey puck in the Irish landscape, or maybe a Los Angeles bank. That is the monument as it was restored for years, really centuries. This just looked like a mound of grass in the Irish countryside with a few edges of stones protruding. And then in the 60s, an Irish archaeologist, Michael J. O'Kelly, did the excavation and restored it. And his restoration led him to believe that the shape in which we see the monument was at least something like what it looked like back when it was new.
So what do you think was the social implication of them building a monument like this? What were they trying to achieve?
You know, that's actually a truly profound question, and I can't pretend that we've absolutely got the answer. This is a prehistoric monument, and that means there's no writing, there's no history. We don't have the owner's manual for this, and so we have to infer its meaning and its purpose and the intent of its builders from what remains. And there are some interesting details to take into account. And the archaeologist, O'Kelly, actually noticed these as he was doing the work. They kind of go back, and this is a little bit of a twisted story, but I hope you'll bear with me. They go back to rumors about this place, really rumors for centuries, where the local people always said, you know, there's some day of the year that the sun shines into the monument. But nobody ever seemed to have a clue when that might be, and there was absolutely no evidence that that could happen. And in those days, the entrance doorway was in fact visible. People knew you could go inside of it, but it was realized that there is no way that sunlight on any day of the year can shine in that doorway and reach all the way back into those chambers. And that's because the floor, as you go into the monument, slopes upward. So any sunlight that might come up from a rising sun would hit that floor and wouldn't get anywhere, wouldn't get to the back chambers. So this was kind of one of those things that the archaeologist just thought was a sort of a local tale and no real substantiation to it. But as they began doing the work on the monument, they discovered that the orientation of the doorway and, in fact, the whole passage is to the southeast, and not just any old direction in the southeast, but toward the winter solstice sunrise, that is, the point of sunrise on the shortest day of the year when the sun rises as far to the south as it does from that location, and then starts moving each day gradually a little bit farther to the north again. So this is really the turning point of the year, and in a sense, the dead of winter. So it was obvious that there was some kind of an aspect of the astronomical line perhaps built into it, maybe a coincidence. But then on top of that, the survey of the monument showed that it's not round, it's kind of heart-shaped, and so it has an axis of symmetry. That axis of symmetry that would split it into two similar halves coincides with the astronomical alignment. So that suggested also that the alignment was probably truly intended. Mm-hmm. And that's where the situation stood until O'Kelly actually really got down to work and made a remarkable discovery.
Now, are these alignments changing over the years as the Earth precesses?
Precession, which is the wobbling of the Earth's axis over a 26,000-year cycle, and that's just due to the gravitational pull, primarily of the Moon, but the Sun, too, on the bulge of the Earth being bulged at its equator. And what that does is shift the stars with respect to the seasons, but it does not alter the location where the Sun would rise at, say, the winter solstice thousands of years ago. There is another effect, another motion of the Earth. It is a very slow change in the angle of our axis in space. Of course, our axis is tilted now 23.5 degrees from straight out vertical. And that tilt of the axis is, in fact, what gives us the seasons, because it alters the amount of sunlight falling on one hemisphere and then the other over the course of our travels around the Sun. Mm-hmm. That effect does alter the position of the Sun, say the sunrise 5,000 years ago. It was in a slightly different position than it is today.
The precession of the axis changes which day on the calendar is winter solstice. Is that correct?
But
you're saying it doesn't.
Actually, the calendar, the precession only changes the stars and in which seasons they appear, and in that sense it will also change a calendar date for those stars. But the calendar's changes actually only are a product of how we contrive our calendars. And none of our calendars are completely congruent with all these motions of the Earth. So they actually drift as well, but independently. And precession isn't really responsible for that, although over time, it's quite right that because of the way we keep the calendar, the seasons change with respect to the season or to the calendar.
So when the Sun came through the door and reached as far back into the monument as it possibly could, that told the people that this was the middle of winter, basically.
Actually, there's still a surprise here.
Oh, okay.
While O'Kelly was doing his excavation, he saw, as he was just pulling the dirt away, he had seen all along the edge of a stone, a layer, a little stone, maybe even like a little a horizontal slab that was just protruding out of the turf. And as he did the excavation, he realized that this stone, which is decorated, is the top of a window. And the window is what you see right above the actual doorway of New Grange. Mm-hmm. That window he called the roof box. And it's even more remarkable than that, because he discovered a block of quartz still sitting in that roof box or window, blocking up half of the window. The other half was open and empty, but down in the rubble on the ground, there was another block of quartz, just the same, and it fit in perfectly. So it obviously had been put in to the upper part of the window at some time in the past and fallen out. Then he examined the stones very carefully, and he saw scraping that would be produced by quartz. And that told him that those quartz blocks that sort of sealed up the window were put in and taken out and put in and taken out repeatedly. And, of course, that was kind of a mysterious thing. So he had a hunch, and he had a hunch about that roof box. And he stationed himself one winter, this is now decades ago, in the very back of New Grange on the morning of the winter solstice and waited for the Sun to come up and, of course, was surprised and delighted to see that the Sun actually comes up and enters that window up above the doorway, and because that window is higher, it permits the light to shoot all the way back in a thin pencil beam all the way back to the inner part of the chamber, where there is, in fact, a carving of three spirals, which was part of this old rumor that somehow the light touched those spirals. Well, in fact, the light hits the floor, it bounces off the floor, and it lights up all of those chambers and gives the complete darkness of that space before the sun comes up. It's black, blacker than night. You can't see a thing in there. And then this light comes up, and suddenly the place comes alive with the light of the sun. And so very obviously, that roof box was designed to allow that sunlight to come in. But the story doesn't even stop there.
That sounds like a very spiritual moment when all of a sudden the blackness turns to light.
Yeah, I think probably people that get to see that are in fact emotionally affected very often.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking with Dr. Edwin Krupp about an ancient observatory in Ireland. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back talking about an ancient observatory in Ireland with Dr. Edwin Krupp. Before our break, Ed was telling us about how the winter solstice sunrise shone through a quartz block into the back chambers of the observatory at Newgrange, Ireland. Ed, how large is this quartz block that we're talking about, if you put the two pieces together?
Oh, you're talking about 3 feet altogether.
That's a huge piece of quartz.
Oh, yeah. No, they're significant. You're quite right.
I mean, they must have really looked long and hard to find a window made of quartz.
Not only that, I mean, when you look at the monument and you see that it's completely white, all of that white rock is quartz on the surface. So they went looking for a lot of quartz and used it in order to decorate the monument. And that's not the only place. I mean, you find throughout these prehistoric monuments in northwestern Europe, the material quartz shows up over and over again, either in big pieces or just in scatters of flakes. So it certainly had a symbolic meaning for people in prehistory. We kind of take these things for granted because we have such a rich catalog of materials, metals and plastics and cloths and all those kinds of things available to us. But in prehistoric times, there weren't all of those materials, and so each material that people encountered had very special properties for them and had high meaning that we might often take for granted.
Amazing. So what else would you like to tell us about the site?
Well, it turns out there are a couple other things that I think are well worth keeping in mind. And first, technically, just about the alignment. After all of this was discovered, there were two more interesting discoveries made. One thing was just noticed. It was there in front of plain sight all along. When you look at the entrance of Newgrange, you see a great big carved stone lying on its side in front of the entrance. It's carved with spirals and diamonds and such. But interestingly, the design is cut in half by a vertical groove. A groove just comes down the front of it that is right, in fact, in front of the doorway. Now, you might not think much of that, but if you go all the way around to the back side of Newgrange, there is another decorated stone. It, too, has designs of diamonds and spirals and such. It's different, but it has that kind of art. And it also has its design cut in half by a vertical groove. So you have two stones on opposite sides of the monument, essentially marking the line that is the line of symmetry and the line to the winter solstice sunrise. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to get much more circumstantial evidence to say they really meant that this alignment was right. part of the deal, and it had meaning to them. Then finally, on top of that, an astrophysicist, an Irish astrophysicist named Tom Ray, several years later, did a much more accurate examination of that roof box, and he determined that when you do the corrections for the calculations that we were talking about earlier of the angle of the sun changing over time, he determined that that roof box window was designed so that when the sun first came up and first appeared in the window, it would appear from the inside right in the lower left corner of the window and then move across the window's diagonal and depart out the corner on the opposite or right and upper side. So they certainly were very, very mindful in their design of this, very deliberate in what they wanted to do. And of course, the question then comes up was, well, what does this mean? You know, what's the story behind all this?
The stone marker, by the way, is image number 3 on the website. And image number 4 shows a graphic of how the winter solstice sun aligns with the monument. And image number 5 is an actual photograph of the sun entering the monument on the morning of winter solstice.
And you know, that photograph actually tells you something really interesting about the monument, because as you look at that picture and listen to this account, what you realize is that window's fairly large. And you mentioned that yourself with the idea of how big those blocks of quartz have to be to fit in there and take out of that. That means that this roof box window will actually allow sunlight inside New Grange, not just on a single day, but on several days around the time of the winter solstice, at least a week before and a week after. And that tells you that this monument was not intended as an astronomical observatory. They weren't trying to find out when the solstice occurs. They already knew that, and you wouldn't build a monument like this for that purpose. This monument is an application of the astronomical knowledge to some other purpose, and that purpose obviously has to do with the sun. It probably has to do with winter and the seasons. And it probably has to do with the rebirth of the world, the idea that the sunlight enters the earth and enlivens it again, revivifies it, fertilizes it with the light of the sun, and then the seasons turn and the sun, in a sense, starts regaining its strength, and the earth does too. Now, we don't know exactly what kind of story people told themselves about all this, but you can imagine that a myth that combined these themes of the sun and renewal and the seasons and winter were certainly part of it. And death as well, because after all, we did find the remains, the cremated remains, ash of bone and such, in the basins that occupy some of those little chambers in the back. Now, that's why they call it a grave, but it's not really a place where people were buried. Those ashes were sacramental. They were obviously the human remains of some very important ancestors who had some symbolic role in the monument. And of course, we'll never be able to reconstruct all of that in detail. But I have to tell you, when I was at New Grange just this past winter solstice and saw what was happening culturally today there, it really hit another signal in my head about how this was used. Because it's hard to imagine a small community of farmers and herders investing in this huge monument and all of the other monuments that are around there. There are two more very large passage graves very close to New Grange, and one of them lines up with the winter solstice sunset. Well, these monuments aren't the kind of thing that a small little community is likely to build just for its own small private ceremony. But what I saw at the winter solstice now is about 200 people converging on New Grange, and these were people actually from all over the world. And we know from some of the archaeological remains and some of the ancient history, not from prehistoric times, that New Grange remained a place of pilgrimage and was probably known internationally in antiquity. So you have to, I think in terms instead of a kind of a small kingdom or a chiefdom that built this thing in part for economic and political purposes as well as religious and ceremonial. And they may have been attracting, in a sense, tourists, although not recreational tourists, but serious political or religious tourists from deep in antiquity.
So people would come to do homage at the center of the cultural capital of their civilization.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's fantastic. And this site, as you say, 30 miles north of Dublin.
Right. It is easy to reach by, superhighway these days.
And it's open to the public?
It is. They have a spectacular new visitor center there. It's not that new anymore, but this visit, my fourth, was the first time I'd seen it. So when you go, if you go on a busy day, all of the opportunities, because they control the access to the site from the visitor center, you may not be able to get in, but you can make reservations online on the web at the Brúna Boyne Visitor Center. So anybody planning on going to Ireland, they should just ahead of time say, hey, I think I want to go there, and make your reservation to visit.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, Ed, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and telling us all about this ancient observatory and at New Grange in Ireland.
Thanks. I enjoyed being a part of your guide to the cosmos.
Thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.